This is Fresh Air. Back with us for a return visit is satirist Harry Shearer. You'll recognize his voice for lots of reasons. He's the voice of Mr. Burns, Principal Skinner, and lots of other characters on The Simpsons. He's a former cast member of Saturday Night Live, and he does the voices of our political leaders and news anchors in his satire on All Things Considered and his own program, Le Show. Shearer is also bass player Derek Smalls in Spinal Tap, the parody of a heavy metal band. He got started in showbiz as a child actor. Tomorrow night at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York, Shearer will present a retrospective of his career, and we're about to do a mini-retrospective focusing on the early years, since we've already talked with him about his recent work. As if to make sure no medium goes unrepresented, now Shearer has a new book, a collection of columns he wrote for the Los Angeles Times Sunday magazine. It's called Man Bites Town. And I wanted to know if he's finding sneaky ways to promote it on his radio show.
No, I've avoided most sneaky ways. I mentioned a couple times that I was doing book signings, but and I have the publicist from my publisher staring at me in the face as I say this. But I always view the the publicizing of my stuff as their job, you know, not to be something where I take time that people like set aside to be entertained by me and say, you know, instead, no, buy this other stuff that I'm selling to be entertained, you know. But I do mention it from time to time.
You have a talk and a retrospective coming up at the Museum of Television and Radio.
Yeah.
So I thought we might walk through briefly some of your TV career and go through some of the highlights of that part of your life. Now, I have a friend who recently saw you on the pilot, he thinks it was, or the first episode of Leave It to Beaver.
It was the pilot.
The pilot.
Mm-hmm.
What did you play?
Eddie Haskell.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You were Eddie Haskell?
Yeah.
Oh, he told me you were Eddie Haskell's friend. You were Eddie Haskell.
Yeah.
You were the obnoxious friend.
Yeah.
What happened? You didn't get the part?
My parents took the position that it was fine for me to work on TV and radio as a child, but they didn't want me being in a series. I think their reasoning was that it would take me out of school. I was going to like regular public school, and then when I'd get a job, I'd go work and come back to school. If you're in a series, you're just in that world forever. You know, you never go back to public school, and you're on the set all the time. I now realize later, with the hindsight that I've accumulated in show business, that it's also not a good idea for a 9 or 10 year old kid to have, you know, 200 guys on the crew standing around going, Kid looks off this week. You know, their paycheck is dependent on a 9-year-old and the pressure of those guys watching him. Kid's losing the cuteness a little bit here. What's happening? You know, you don't want that. So I'm very glad that happened.
You'd have to be in a self-help group now for...
for aging child stars.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, they all have such problems.
Yeah. Not that I don't have problems, Terry, but...
Well, at least they're different problems.
That's right.
I know when I was growing up, a lot of times when there were child actors... And some of what I'm thinking is, of course, from films that were made a little earlier. But a lot of the child actors, the male child actors, were in short pants,
mm-hmm.
and were really whiny and obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to play that type of person?
No, because I was dark-haired, I basically played like Italian street kids, you know, who had to be rescued from a life of having a gangland name attached to them by the time they were, you know. Get this kid and save him before somebody starts calling him the Chin, you know, parts like that. There's a lot of typecasting with children, you know, and if you're blonde or redheaded and freckle-faced, why, you get different parts than if you're dark-haired.
Did you ever play anybody Jewish?
Ostensibly Jewish? No, I don't think so.
I don't think there were many ostensibly Jewish characters.
About the only one I guess would have been, if people knew, I played Jack Benny as a child a couple times on his show, and if they figured out that Jack Benny was Jewish, then they might have figured out that I was playing a Jewish character.
Was Jack Benny nice to you?
He was the greatest. I did his show a lot. After the third time I did his radio show, he came out into the hallway behind the studio after the show was over, gave me this huge hug, and gave me a transcription of the show that we just finished. And it was just, from then on, it was he was so warm and kind to me. He was very generous, very smart, very generous in the sense of liking the fact, not just allowing the people around him to get laughs, but really liking the fact that the supporting players on his program got laughs. I remember vividly the first time I made him laugh in a rehearsal. We were reading the script and sitting around a table, and I ad-libbed a little thing. And I mean, I was a kid. was, you know, 8 or 9 years old, and to see Jack Benny not just laugh, but, I mean, laugh uproariously and hit the table was so amazing.
What did you say? I mean, what did you say that got him laughing?
I was playing, the Beverly Hills Beavers were doing their version of Jack Benny's radio show, so I was playing Sheldon Leonard, the guy who played the racetrack. Hey, bud, come here a minute, I got to hit the... I forget exactly what I said. It may have just been something I did with my voice. I don't know, but I mean, I remember I did a little something, and all of a sudden Jack Benny is like hitting, you know, pounding the table, laughing. It was easy for him to be generous in giving the supporting players around him laughs because he always knew he could get a great laugh by reacting to them. That said, a lot of people in show business, a lot of people in comedy, aren't that smart to know that they can always get a good laugh by reacting and get very jealous of people around them getting any laughs at all. He was also one of the first people I knew who owned his own show.
Oh.
Very smart guy.
One thing I always loved about Jack Benny, one of the many things, is that he could just make that, you know, that little like annoyed smirk that he'd have when he'd mm-hmm. hold his two fingers up to his chin mm-hmm. and he'd just roll his eyes a little and look away. He'd get so much out of that one gesture.
Yeah.
Did that give you ideas when you were young and watching him?
What gave me, you know, what really inspired me was watching him have this character that, if you analyzed his character, or any of the great comic characters, but let's take Benny. You know, he was a miser, he was vain, mm-hmm. he was a bad employer, he was all these comically unpleasant things, and yet he was beloved. And, you know, you flash forward to the recent past, and television executives particularly, and also movie executives, have had the idea that comic characters had to be, quote, likable. That is to say, they had to be characters composed of likable characteristics. Well, likable characteristics aren't funny. Which is why you have characters in sitcoms with no definable character just trading wisecracks with each other. Because there's nothing funny about the characters, that's all been shaved off. Benny showed, you know, marvelously well how lovable you can be being not lovable.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Harry Shearer. And Harry has a new book called Man Bites Town. That's a collection of columns that he used to write for the magazine of the Los Angeles Times. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Harry Shearer. You might have told me this before in another interview, I'm not sure, but how...
I never repeat myself, Terry.
I never asked a question twice. How did you get started as an actor at so young an age?
I had a piano teacher starting from when I was 4, and I like to think that I helped her make the decision to have a career change. And she decided to become a children's agent, and partly because she had a child of her own who was working in show business, so she had those connections. And she said to my parents, for reasons best known to her, do you mind if I try to get Harry some work? And they said, sure. And 7 or 8 months went by, and it was sort of like a family joke. Have we heard from Mrs. McMillan yet? No. And then she called up one day and said, there's an audition for the Jack Benny Show. And I went in and got it.
So that was your first part?
That was my first thing I did in show business, yeah.
And when was Beaver in relation to that?
It was about 3 years later. I think I was 10.
You know, when I was growing up, I thought, like, well, if I really reach that pinnacle, I'll be able to meet someone from the Mickey Mouse Club and befriend them. You know, I mean, I just thought, like, wow, wouldn't it be swell to know somebody was actually on television?
Mm.
And what was it like for you to actually be on the box?
Well, I really loved that world. I mean, it was an escape from what I found to be the incredibly boring world of my fellow children. So any time I could go into that world, it was just, hey, this is where I want to be. You know, it was cool. I got to, school was wrapped up, pardon me, in like 3 hours. You'd have the tutor on the set, and they'd do school real fast to get you ready for work. And then you were either working, and that was fun, or you'd sit around, you know, reading the trades and eating good food for lunch at the commissary and hanging around with grown-ups, you know? It was so hip. I loved it.
Who were some of the people who took you under their wing or tried to introduce you to things that kids weren't supposed to be introduced to? A lot of adults really take pride in doing that.
Well, I my best memory in terms of a guy who took me under his wing, and it's either ironic or fitting given what I've been doing in later life, was Mel Blanc. Who was the great voice genius of the Warner Brothers cartoons and was also one of the regulars in the Jack Benny Show. And I'll never forget, it was very early on in my career on the Benny Show, but my parents always used to sit upstairs, and this was the radio show, and there were two booths. There was a control room behind glass where the crew sat, you know, the technical crew. And there was a booth upstairs also behind glass where the sponsors sat and where, you know, guests could sit too. It was called the client's booth. And my parents would always sit there. They'd watch me from above. And I could always get eye contact with them by looking up there. And one show they decided, we're going to go see what it looks like from out in the audience. So they do that. And before the show begins, Don Wilson, we're all standing out in the hallway, and Don Wilson, the announcer of the show, introduces every cast member to the audience. And so when you hear Don Wilson call your name, you walk into the studio, take a bow, and sit down. And we're standing out in the hallway talking, and I hear, "Harry!" And I open the door and walk in. And instead of getting this little, my little usual smattering of applause, I get a huge laugh. And I, you know, I think I probably looked down to check my zipper, and that was okay, and sat down, and Mel Blanc was sitting there next to me. He'd already been introduced, and he explained to me that the reason they were laughing was because Don Wilson hadn't been introducing me. He'd been calling Mary from Mary Livingston. And I was, you know, destroyed. I couldn't find my parents anywhere. They were out in the audience where I couldn't see him, and he was just, you know, he made it possible for me to go on that night. But he was very sweet and kind to me all the way through the time that I knew him on The Benny Show.
What did he do that made you feel better?
Just, you know, talk to me about, you know, it was funny and it's not a bad thing to get a laugh. And, you know, that they're not down on me because of it. And I didn't screw up the show and, you know, explained all the things that a child at that point might be afraid that he'd done, which I was.
Your parents, I believe, were immigrants from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
What did they make of you being in the middle of American popular culture when they were so new to the culture?
I think, they were proud. It got them into a world that they would never have experienced otherwise. You know, they were, I think they were, the thing that amazed them most was the other parents of the kids, you know. They would look around at the behavior of these other parents of kids and just shake their heads in amazement that people could be like this with their kids and with other grown-ups, you know. It, as we were talking before, you know, the parents of a lot of child actors have some serious problems and very often force the kids into the business, and you see that behavior close at hand, and I think that shocked them more than anything else.
Where were they from?
My mom is from Poland and my dad was from Austria.
And what did they do for a living?
Well, you know, as immigrants, they did what they had to. That's not to say they violated any laws. My dad had trained as an opera singer, and he ran a gas station. And my mom had been educated as an accountant and ended up being a restaurant bookkeeper.
Right. Okay, let's continue our procession through your early acting career.
Okay.
Any other TV shows I should know about from the early days, from Harry Shearer, the early days?
Probably the most significant other ones I did were Alfred Hitchcock and Ann Southern.
Ann Southern, where she was the secretary?
Yeah, yeah. That was one where I was like a bad kid whom she rescues from the streets. And the most prestigious show I ever did, in the early days of television, there was this wonderful Sunday afternoon program called Omnibus, which sort of was an all-purpose arts show that covered the waterfront. And I did that once when Jack Benny was recreating his historic flop movie, The Horn Blows at Midnight. But I did, you know, an awful lot of what was going on at that time in television.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were on GE Theater, right? Mm-hmm. Is that the one Ronald Reagan hosted?
Yeah, it sure was. Mm-hmm. During it was, he'd not only host it, but he'd go out to the GE plants all over the country and do the thing with the light bulb and such.
Did you meet him?
No.
Oh, what a shame.
Yeah, what a shame. He came in and did all his stuff, you know, at one time. You know, he'd host 20 shows at a crack and then go off and do his touring of the...
do the hello and say the fellas, you're making good light bulbs, keep it up. You know, do that.
Oh, gee, I'm so disappointed that you didn't meet him. You could have started studying him at an early age.
At an early age. You can't study people at an early age. I have a very distinct memory of being on the radio with partners of mine and talking about the people who were difficult to do. And at the time, Reagan was governor of California, and we agreed that he was one of the most difficult people to do. But as public figures get older, possibly because they learn what it is that works and keep doing that, they increasingly become caricatures of themselves. And so they save you the effort. You don't have to caricature them. You just do them. And he became incredibly easy to do as time went on. I think that that's, you know, that they all have handlers and advisors who tell them, do this, this is what works. And that's what sort of makes them narrower and narrower, narrower and narrower as people and easier to do as a result.
Mm-hmm. What was the last time that you had an acting role, you know, as a young person?
I was 15. It was probably a Benny show or a series that was on called, at that time, called TV Reader's Digest, in which I guess they took stories from the magazine and condensed them further for television.
Well, that sounds exciting.
Yeah. For people for whom the Reader's Digest was tough reading.
Was this a conscious effort to give up the business?
Yeah, I retired from the business at the age of 15 because I was starting college, and I thought, I breezed my way through school, and I thought, well, college I'm going to have to take seriously. And about the first week I got there, I went to work for the school paper, and there went that notion.
So what got you back into show business?
Trying jobs that weren't in show business.
Trying and failing?
No, not failing, just not liking them as much as I like show business.
Uh-huh.
I taught school for a couple of years. I wrote journalism. I wrote advertising. I worked at the state legislature in California. And when I had the opportunity to do this stuff again, I thought, yeah, more fun.
My guest is Harry Shearer. More in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is satirist, actor, and writer Harry Shearer. You've talked with us before on the show about Spinal Tap, the parody of the heavy metal band that you've been a part of for years. But you've got another band that you're going to be doing more with, and that's called The Folksmen.
Yes.
Tell us about The Folksmen.
Well, The Folksmen is a superannuated folk trio that broke up about 25 years ago.
Do they have a PBS special yet?
No, they don't, but it should be in the cards. They'll be appearing at a folk fest. They opened for Spinal Tap in London. If you saw our television special or see our video, they were attempting to open for Spinal Tap at Royal Albert Hall, but were booed off the stage before they ever set foot on it. And they'll be making their first actual public appearance in Los Angeles at an actual bona fide folk festival coming up in June. And their repertoire includes a song which is not so much a traditional folk ballad as a summation of most traditional folk ballads. It centers around a train wreck inside a coal mine called Blood on the Coal. They've gotten together recently. You know, they all have other jobs. One of them teaches at Swarthmore, and they're still politically active, you know, as folk people have to be. And two of them have no hair, and one of them has hair that of suspicious origins.
And who are you?
I'm the guy, one of the guys with no hair. I'm the bass player. I'm probably the most politically committed of the group. I'm always trying to get songs about the Spanish Civil War back into our repertoire. And I have that awful little beard that never comes above the chin line, you know?
What are the folk bands that you particularly liked or hated, the folk groups?
Well, Kingston Trio, you had to hate, you know. They were the great boilers down of every tradition. I have to go on record since you've asked me this question, saying I really never liked Dylan. He wrote, you know, about a dozen good songs early on and has been coasting for the last 30 years on his reputation. Now makes public appearances where he sounds like he's been breathing helium right before going on stage. Who did I like in folk? I love Joni Mitchell and Joan Baez, you know. And there was this guy who used to sing folk songs and had radio shows from time to time. Would rescue really obscure folk songs. Oscar Brand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He used to be on NPR, actually.
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So listen, when you're doing the folk group, are you good at singing the tight harmonies that folk groups sing in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We'll be doing that. We'll be very tight.
All right. Well, Harry, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you, Terry. It was always a pleasure.
Satirist Harry Shearer, his new collection of columns from the Los Angeles Times is called Man Bites Town. Tomorrow, he speaks at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York.